You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of The Last Stand by Nate Freeman. But first, a note. The artist's name is properly pronounced Arthur Jaffa. Now to the article. Watching Prince calmly talk his way through his career while the attorneys bark increasingly absurd lines of attack at him is strangely engrossing and at times uproariously funny. But at a certain point, the dialogue crosses the Rubicon from surreal and enters into a truly transcendent moment of contemporary art. Just after the five-hour mark, the lawyers slide across the table as evidence an image that Prince had posted to his Twitter account a few days before. Exhibit 187 is a picture of a shoehorn. Prince found it on the ground outside the Met and decided it was art. His art. I realized then they had been trolling me because I had put this image out a couple of days before the deposition, he said, and by put out, he meant tweeted. And when that thing came across the table, I think if you watch enough Law and Order, you're told that you don't ask a question unless you know the answer. Well, when they slipped that, they didn't know what the answer was going to be. Prince told me that this, among all other moments, is when he knew that the deposition could be an artwork. Do you recognize Exhibit 187? A lawyer off-screen asked Prince. Yes, Prince says. What is Exhibit 187? The lawyer asked. A good question, Prince says. It's everything. And what do you mean by that? Says the lawyer. It's my entire life, Prince says. What is the photo in Exhibit 187 of? Says the lawyer. It's art history. It's an African mask. It's cubism. It's a little bit of Calder. It's a Duchamp. It's definitely Man Ray. It's a found object. It's a ready-made. It's a nod. Reminds me of a Hans Bellmer. And in a more contemporary sense. And this is someone who really, a very good friend of mine, who's actually having an exhibit at the moment, Robert Gober. So, in a strange way, what you're looking at is about 118 years of art history here. He goes on, no one stopping him. I mean, this is an image that is actually too good to be true. Hard to believe, almost impossible, really real, almost real. It's so real that it's not real. And yet in the end, this is what appropriation is about, he says. It's basically a shoehorn. But is it a shoehorn? It's not. It's not because I say it's not. It's not a shoehorn because I just explained what it really is. I was actually thinking about bringing it here today to explain what appropriation is, he finishes. After this, Charles Munn, a lawyer for the plaintiffs, breaks in unexpectedly, at which point the camera cuts out. I ask Prince what happened during that gap in filming. It was kind of a 15-minute rap about the history of art, and I just remember the lawyer standing up and started yelling to my lawyer, "Can you please tell your client to stop?" Prince said. And of course, I just kept looking at the video. At that moment, it became a little performance. There are many moments like that throughout deposition. There's a digression on whether Andy Kaufman's stand-up act was considered a performance art. There's a long talk about whether taking a screenshot on an iPhone is an act of creative expression. There's a long narrative about how the Guggenheim purchased a hunting lodge studded with in situ works from Prince ahead of his retrospective, only to have a lightning strike destroy the house 2 months before the show opened. Prince bought it back from the Guggenheim. At one point, They press him on whether or not he is an investor in an East Hampton Tex-Mex tequila joint with Ron Perelman. I hope not, he says. The lawyers finally break character and lose it. I believe, unfortunately, I have a very small stake in a restaurant. I believe it's called the Blue Parrot, he says, audibly pained by this knowledge. Deposition is one of the funniest pieces of video art this century. All deadpan, no punchlines. And this might be the only time someone actually laughs during the proceedings. A real joke. But above all, it is, like Empire, an art film depicting a single thing for an extended duration with a camera that stays still, allowing the object on screen to become a solitary hero, a gunslinger at the saloon gates, a holy man preaching from an altar, an artist at an easel, a citizen before the authorities. I mean, all the heretics have been brought before the court, haven't they? It is such an ancient structure, Gavin Brown said. About halfway through a tour of Prince's secret, off-the-grid, very remote, town-sized compound of studios in the Catskills, flanked by Prince's studio manager, Matthew Goggin, and two assistants, with the sun setting over the mountains, I realized this was one of the great cultural experiences of my life. I was lucky. Very few people have seen Prince's art fiefdom in Rensselaerville. It's kind of Marfa, upstate, and it's to me as relevant as Marfa, Gagosian told me. It's kind of like, and here the great dealer pauses for effect, Richardville. He first came up here on a fishing trip with the artist Peter Naden. They got lost and ended up in Rensselaerville, a colonial-era one-streeter. And his compound is outside of town, pretty much impossible to find without the precise instructions I was given. I drove through on a recent Friday with my dog. Suddenly, I was hauling ass up a big dirt road that led to a plateau overlooking the high Catskills. On the right was a long row of warehouses. It was like passing into another dimension. There's no through road. There are five roads that lead in. It's almost like a dead end, Prince told me, maintaining the mystery. It's not built like a traditional town, where there's one entrance, you go in, and then you go out. Geographically, it's an interesting spot. Very close to town, but yet it's still in the middle of nowhere. If Prince's Irv is the secret history of America, as seen through the radical politics of its counterculture, this was the skeleton key. There's a dozen buildings, each sprawling, and you zip around on golf carts. Passing sculptures by Frank Stella and Urs Fischer, there's a decaying treehouse and a gigantic rotten tree next to the original ranch abode. There's an operational body shop full of cars mid-chop where Prince gets the hoods that he paints, but also a monster truck that's been vinyl-wrapped with pinups in the truck bed. There are full-size galleries installed with his own work and full-size galleries installed with his art collection. There are multiple Jean Prouvé structures, one inside a warehouse housing Prince's collection, David Hammond's, Naden, Bradley, and a Prouvé gas station housing new sculptures, upside-down outboard tugboat motors. It looks like an alien invasion. There's a room with some of the best cowboys, including a sculpture of a boy dressed in Western garb on a wooden plinth with gunshot shrapnel courtesy of Prince. It's actually not wood. Prince made the sculpture, put it on a wooden plinth, shot the shit out of it with a shotgun, then cast it all in bronze. As we walked around, we played the Is It Prawns game. Those sure look like wooden planks or rubber tire planters. Nope, it's cast bronze. When McWinnie, his beloved book dealer, died in a tragic snorkeling accident in the British Virgin Islands, Prince walked to his desk in a daze and found his Rolodex open to McWinnie's card. So he cast the Rolodex in bronze, just like that. That rotten tree with the treehouse has to come down soon. Prince is going to cast it in bronze and reinstall it. It'll be his largest artwork ever. There's a library with archives, including the first handwritten jokes, which Prince made on index cards and installed inside cassette tapes as frames. I've been married for 34 years, and I'm still in love with the same woman. If my wife ever finds out, she'll kill me. There's his CD collection, the classics, along with a few choice newer records by acts such as Bright Eyes, The Decemberist, Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, Kings of Leon, My Chemical Romance, and the soundtrack to There Will Be Blood. The knickknacks include models of cruise ships lined up in a row, a printout of Magritte's The Treachery of Images, with the text under the pipe reading Ce n'est pas une prince, the postcard of the cobblestone street in the Panama Canal Zone, pictures of his kids, and a box that reads Jimi Hendrix Unit. Inside was a plaster cast of Hendrix's penis. There's a full-scale clay model of a Ford muscle car surrounded by some of the most classic cowboy works, all museum-level, astounding. And there's also a strange sculpture installed amid the best pure view of the Catskill Mountains I've ever seen, an iron-wrought gate to nowhere. Given the breadth of his work on display here, one might think it's a prince. It's not. It's a sculpture by Bob Dylan. According to Prince, they have some kind of a relationship, as the artist has done studio visits with Dylan the painter and collected a bunch of Dylan grails over the years. The original Milton Glaser drawing for the poster included in early pressings of Bob Dylan's greatest hits, Dylan's handwritten lyrics to Like a Rolling Stone. Prince owns the original 1962 acetates of songs from Dylan's first record, bought from producer John Hammond. In deposition, he calls Dylan a mentor and a friend. "Richard's always kind of thinking about Bob Dylan," Coggan said as we stared at the gate and the rolling hills of the mountain range. There was even a rumor that Prince was secretly making the artworks that appeared in the singer's solo show at Gagosian, though everyone denies it, and I don't believe that's actually the case. Regardless, there's an obvious kinship between Prince and Zimmerman. They've invented in themselves the America they want to see. They printed the legend, "I never had a penny to my name, so I changed my name." Dylan has been either in my life or close to it for most of my adult years, Prince said, in There Goes My Hero, an essay for the Gagosian book accompanying Dylan's 2011 show at 980 Madison. Dylan hadn't responded to my questions as a press time. It was a lot to take in, the enormity of Rensselaerville, and it made me think about what would happen to it in the future, in the decades to come. This incredible secret town. Prince is getting up there in age. Turns out, Prince was willing to talk pretty openly about what might happen after he's gone. He's thought about whether Rensselaerville could be a Marfa-like place. Though perhaps not, like the original, a bucket list selfie spot. And yet, it's hard to imagine a scenario in which it's just hidden away forever. That's something we've thought about, and I'm not any closer to making a determination, only because I've got family involved, and they need to be part of it, and I don't know if they want to be part of it, Prince told me. And I don't blame them if they don't want to be part of it. I know I won't be part of it, because I'll be gone, so it's not going to make any difference. I ask him about the Marfa thing. Maybe he's into that plan. He currently has a show up at Max Hetzler's Seoul, U.S. space, which happens to be there. He didn't go for the installation, typically. He doesn't love the idea of hanging out in dead artist studios. "I've never been to Marfa," he revealed to me. "I have been to Judd's place on Mercer, and I've been to the de Kooning house, the Pollock. I found going to the de Kooning house a little weird, to be in someone's..." He paused, thinking about the homes of his artist heroes being turned into tourist attractions. I certainly don't want that, he said. But there is a way forward. He knows that artists have estates, and whatever happens with his work, with his legacy, with Rensselaerville, Richard Prince's America will outlive Richard Prince, the person. There's an opportunity there, but I don't know how to frame it yet, he said. Maybe it could be something that's different. Maybe something could be invented that could be different. Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration, or rather a painting, by David Hockney. Larry Gagosian, 28 to 29 September, from 82 Portraits and Still Lifes, 2013, copyright David Hockney, and photo by Richard Schmidt. Larry Gagosian, the world's grandest art dealer and new owner of Bookhampton, the celebrated tome slinger to East End Brahmins, on Sommering and Capri, wading in warm St. Bart's waters, his custom-made pool cue, and sitting for David Hockney. What is your idea of perfect happiness? A good night's sleep. What is your greatest fear? Antibiotic-resistant infection. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Casanova. What do you dislike most about your appearance? A few years ago, I was very fortunate that David Hockney asked if he could paint my portrait, and I think it turned out great. Over the 3 days that I sat for him, I did my best to keep my stomach flat, but when I saw the finished painting, it was clear that I had not succeeded. What is your greatest extravagance? My custom-made pool cue. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Ghosting. What is your favorite journey? Climbing the stairs to Casa Malaparte in Capri every summer. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Frugality. Which living person do you most despise? Guess. Which word or phrase do you most overuse? What the F? What is your greatest regret? I did not stick with my piano lessons as a kid. When and where were you happiest? Swimming in the ocean in St. Bart's. Which talent would you most like to have? I really wish I could tap dance. What is your current state of mind? Productively confused. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? My impatience. What do you consider your greatest achievement? My gallery. What is your most treasured possession? My restaurant, Capo Massa. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Loneliness. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? I wish I'd gotten to know them better. What is your favorite occupation? Luckily, the one that I have. Who are your favorite writers? Raymond Chandler and Emma Klein. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Leonardo da Vinci, who was both real and mythical. Who are your heroes in real life? I have always been more drawn to the anti-heroes. What are your favorite names? Cy and Bryce. What is it that you most dislike? When there are not enough chocolate chips in a scoop of chocolate chip ice cream. How would you like to die? In 100 years, on Mars. What is your motto? Only the paranoid survive. And that was the Proust Questionnaire with Larry Gagosian. broken-hearted. Barbara Guggenheim and Abigail Asher were, until recently, grand dames of the art market, outfitting the most powerful people in the world with killer portfolios. Then, in a flurry of mutual allegations ranging from sexual favors to fraud, the two women parted ways. As their battle heads to court, Evgenia Peretz reports. Opening photos, gallery girls. Barbara Guggenheim, photographed in New York by Blair Getz Mezbov for Vanity Fair, and Abigail Asher, sittings editor Rebecca Dennett. And next photo, art of the deal. Guggenheim with her first husband, the late Burt Fields, in a 1993 issue of Vanity Fair. Sitting with Barbara Guggenheim in the stately, well-appointed living room of the Park Avenue apartment that she shares with her second husband, the wealthy venture capitalist Alan Patrikoff, one feels as if in the presence of a Sargent portrait, if he were painting in sunblasted minimalist 2025. Guggenheim is dressed beautifully in a crisp, midi-length white skirt, white sweater, both by Attersey, a brand founded by her niece Isabel Wilkinson Shore, and white low sneakers. The look matches her sleek white blonde hair pulled back in a clip. At 78, her face is as unlined as that of a 40-year-old, her jawline exquisitely sharp. From the viewer's position, Guggenheim, the pioneer and grand dame of the rarefied field of art advising, looks every inch the woman who has achieved it all and wants for nothing. She didn't have children, but she had a younger woman in her life, her business partner, Abigail Asher, who may as well have been a daughter. Together, over the course of more than three decades, they fill the homes of billionaires and celebrities, Tom Cruise, Steven Spielberg, with work of blue-chip artists, while elevating the hallways of mega-corporations like Coca-Cola and Sony. I considered her almost a part of my family, Guggenheim says. I even personally paid for a part of her son's school tuition. That was not a loan. It was my gift to them. That was years ago, before Guggenheim and Asher's professional love story exploded in the worst kind of divorce, with dueling legal complaints, personal attacks, and scandalous claims about sex and corruption. Guggenheim is alleging that Asher stole from their company to fund her lifestyle, and that she launched her own competing advisory in secret. Asher is countering that it's Guggenheim who dipped into the business, and that she had been bullying, threatening, and gaslighting Asher for the better part of her career. Both women are aghast at the other's claims. Art world colleagues, still reeling from the conviction of top art advisor Lisa Schiff for defrauding clients out of millions, are in fresh states of shock. After all, the two women were a bedrock of the industry and seemed to be the perfect match. Guggenheim was the high-flying, glamorous face of the firm, giving lectures around the country, pairing masterpieces with masters of the universe. Asher was the younger, serious Brit working out of New York, bringing in a new generation of moneyed clients and nurturing them with care and fastidiousness. It really did seem at the time like a match made in heaven, says L.A. art advisor Patricia Pizer, who has worked closely with them for 20 years and admires them both. Now, big league names on both sides are jumping to each woman's defense. Abigail's as honest as the day is long, an absolute stickler for form, says longtime friend Adam Chin, former COO of Sotheby's, who's done multiple deals with her. She's professional to the point of being beyond meticulous. As for Guggenheim, her close friend Michael Ovitz, CAA co-founder and a major collector, says, "She's one of the most trustworthy people that I know. I've never ever in 45 years caught her in anything duplicitous, any fibs, any storytelling, any lack of integrity, and Abigail's trying to destroy her at this time is just crazy. Indeed, Asher's complaint is the more personal of the two, and today Guggenheim is stung. It was filled, Guggenheim says, with vindictive, crazy lies and exaggerations that were very dismaying to see, very upsetting from someone I had had a relationship with for 3 decades. There's only personal allegations and character assassination. As Guggenheim continues talking back in the Park Avenue apartment, the iciness melts. Her voice shakes at times, and her blue eyes evince vulnerability. The impression of her shifts to Lioness and Winter, doing her best to keep her head high and hold on to her mane and reputation, her name and reputation, as the woman who put her industry on the map. Guggenheim is not related to the Guggenheim Museum family, though having that name couldn't have hurt. She didn't come from wealth. Her father was the owner of dress shops in Woodbury, New Jersey. In 1968, when she moved to New York to start on her master's in art history at Columbia, there was just one major gallery in Soho, the Paula Cooper Gallery. She worked her way through graduate school by giving talks at the Whitney Museum every Saturday and Sunday about whatever art was up. One day in the mid-1970s, one of the women in the group asked if Guggenheim would take her to Soho to visit some galleries. By now, more were popping up in the increasingly exotic neighborhood, filled with the world's most avant-garde characters. Think Soho, circa Martin Scorsese's After Hours. As Uptown's guide through this exciting demi-monde, Guggenheim could see that she was on to something. In 1975, she started her own business, Art Tours of Manhattan, taking locals and tourists to museums, galleries, and artist studios, like those of Bernard Vanet and Christo and Jean-Claude. I had to really understand what that artist was doing and be able to explain it to people who didn't have an art vocabulary but had the sensitivity and wanted to learn, she says. There were plenty of rich people among the crowd. As Guggenheim tells it, a certain woman had just bought an apartment in UN Plaza, hired Angelo Donghia, the famous designer of the day, to decorate it, and now she wanted paintings. Could Guggenheim help her? I advised them to buy a Lichtenstein painting, a Donald Judd sculpture, and several other things. And at the end of the year, I looked at my balance sheet, and I saw I had made a lot more money helping this woman buy art for her apartment than I did on many, many, many tours. But I'd never met anyone who could afford to have a painting before. Next photo, beautiful mess. Asher first worked for Guggenheim as an administrative assistant in 1987, and the two are pictured here together. When she turned this into a business in 1981, Barbara Guggenheim Associates, BGA, she was the only one doing work of that kind. There were other advisors out there, but they worked for museums. New galleries were exploding. The Lower East Side became the hotspot, recalls Guggenheim, who'd feed their business with a growing stream of clients. Dealers, gallerists, and auction houses were delighted to see me bringing new clients to their businesses. Uptown, meanwhile, Impressionism was all the rage. If you went into an apartment on Fifth Avenue, it would have French 18th century furniture, puddling drapery, and French Impressionist paintings. She recalls the couple trying to replicate the look, telling her, "We like Renoir, but we can't afford it. What do we do?" So I introduced them to American Impressionism, and they went on and created one of the best collections of American Impressionism in the world. 20 years before Carrie Bradshaw, Guggenheim was living a kind of Sex and the City life, attracting Mr. Biggs of the day, like Goldman Sachs partner and collector Arthur Altschul and collector Stuart Pivar. As she told Vanity Fair in 1993, "I was a single woman, and those were the people I was meeting. Who else was I supposed to sleep with?" To Pace Gallery founder Arne Glimcher, with whom she's done deals over the decades, Her cerebralness was as alluring as her style. She was very serious, he says, and the most important thing was that she was interested in the history of art. Word traveled to Hollywood about the sharp and fetching young woman. Through New York dealer Nicky Wyeth, the son of painter Andrew Wyeth, she met producer Ray Stark, who introduced her to Aaron and Candy Spelling, whose 56,000-square-foot house she helped adorn with Impressionist paintings. She was and is a rainmaker, says Pizer. She has an uncanny talent for finding the exact right piece for a particular client's taste. She will walk in a house with you and in about 10 minutes get a sense of what would make this collector happy and enrich their lives. When a young Ovitz came to New York on business, he'd make the journey to Soho with Guggenheim. She introduced me to all the movements going on at the time, he says. The two hit it off, and their relationship became like brother and sister, says Ovitz. His stock in Hollywood was at its peak, and before long, her Los Angeles client list became a Rolodex worth of A-list operators. Spielberg, Cruise, Jeffrey Katzenberg, Don Simpson, agent Ron Meyer, producers Kathleen Kennedy, and her husband Frank Marshall, who became friends. Ovitz introduced her to another power player, Hollywood super lawyer Burt Fields, the fearsome attorney who purportedly never lost a trial, whom she fell in love with and married in 1991. Because of Fields, Guggenheim relocated to Malibu, and her social circle expanded to include Warren Beatty and Annette Bening, Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft, and Dustin Hoffman. Joining forces, they became one of Los Angeles's it couples, posing for Vanity Fair in black tie on a Malibu beach. With the most powerful people she could hold her own, says Glimcher, she was invited to everything. In 1987, a 23-year-old Abigail Asher walked into her bold-faced life. Raised in London, Asher had gotten a B.A. in art history from the University of Manchester and was looking for work in the art world. A friend introduced the two. As it happened, Guggenheim's work was exploding in Los Angeles, and she needed someone to handle administrative affairs in New York. It seemed to be the start of something beautiful. Asher saw in Guggenheim someone who could be her mentor and took pride in the fact that this was a woman-led company in a world that was dominated by men. As for Guggenheim, she found in Asher someone she could rely on, and then some. Asher diligently managed the company, and Guggenheim, true to her word, mentored her as an art advisor. Asher began cultivating her own relationships with dealers and collectors, bringing in two of the firm's biggest buyers. One of them, hedge fund manager and philanthropist Donald Sussman, recalls how the young woman's shrewdness was on display from the start. In 1990, aware of his interest in surrealism, she called him to report that the communications and advertising firm Saatchi & Saatchi was in financial straits and had a spectacular Magritte they'd be keen to unload. She and I flew overnight from Newark to London, Sussman recalls. They brought the painting to the Concord Lounge. I brought with me a certified check. I handed them the check. She took the painting. I went back to New York. She brought it back to New York. And it was my first significant painting I ever bought. Years later, on one of the many trips that Asher and Sussman made to Art Basel, she spotted a Mark Bradford that took his breath away, and he wanted it. The dealer declined. He only wanted to sell it to a museum. But Asher persevered on Sussman's behalf, persuading the dealer that Sussman was a worthy collector with whom the dealer should want to be in business. I own it because Abigail is so highly regarded by these people, says Sussman. You might say she was turning into a young Barbara Guggenheim, but with East Coast financiers instead of celebrities. Guggenheim was duly impressed, and in 1995 offered to make Asher a co-owner of the business. But Asher turned her down, At the time, according to Guggenheim's complaint, Asher explained that it was because, as a non-U.S. citizen, she didn't want to be a business owner in the U.S. But she asked that her name be put on the door and that the name of the company be changed to Guggenheim Asher Associates, GAA, and Guggenheim agreed. The women made an oral agreement in which they would split all proceeds 50-50, less the expenses. But the pages of Asher's legal complaint, filed in July, paint a very different picture of the women's relationship, at least from Asher's perspective. Those early years were not some idyll between mentor and mentee. On the contrary, as the complaint reads, as Guggenheim introduced Asher to the art world, Guggenheim exposed the troubled inner workings of how she ran her life and work. We are told that Guggenheim, unmarried for the first few years, had sexual relationships with multiple dealers and collectors, and those relationships involved sexual favors and kickbacks pertaining to the business. No specific evidence to that effect is cited. A single incident is presented that illustrates what may have been a conflict of interest. In 1988, Guggenheim had procured a painting of the Pietà by William Adolphe Bouguereau for her client Sylvester Stallone, and the seller was Pivar, her one-time paramour. Stallone later discovered that the painting had what he believed were slashes in it that had been restored. He sued her on the grounds that she had misrepresented the piece and was acting for the benefit of her ex-boyfriend, not him. Guggenheim has said that the slashes were in fact just folds as a result of having been rolled at one point. It's unclear to what extent her prior relationship affected the deal. The suit was later settled. Guggenheim often tried to force these degrading values onto Asher, the complaint goes on to say. It chronicles how she tried to set Asher up on dates with older men whom she viewed as prospective clients. How on one occasion she told Asher not to go to a client's house unless she was prepared to sleep with them. How on another occasion, when Guggenheim sent Asher to Los Angeles to help sell a Warhol, she told her to wear leather and be provocative. Guggenheim, we are told, encouraged Asher to build a relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, with whom Guggenheim and her sister were close, and that Epstein and his girlfriend, Ghislaine Maxwell, were going to be a good source of rich contacts. Asher's attorney, Luke Nikas, declined to answer when the alleged conversation took place. Epstein wasn't investigated until 2005. In response to these personal allegations, Guggenheim's attorney, William Sharon, says, "Miss Asher is obviously hoping to litigate in the press and not in the court, thinking she has a better chance of applying public pressure on Ms. Guggenheim than actual legal pressure. Ms. Asher's legal claims are indeed meritless, and her allegations are false and defamatory." If what is claimed in her complaint is true, then it's possible that Asher felt like she was getting pimped out by her boss. It's also possible that she misread Guggenheim's intentions. Indeed, to Guggenheim's defenders, the essence of Asher's portrayal does not square with the woman they know. "I can't picture Barbara telling Abigail to sleep with one of their clients," says Ovitz. "It's just not her. I've never heard anything like that out of her mouth. She's one of the most elegant, charming, intelligent women I've ever met." As for Guggenheim's suggestion about the leather, "it's beyond hilarious to anyone that knows Barb," says Pizer. "Barb's wardrobe is famously chic and conservative. I never saw her in anything but shades of black, white, and cream, with necklines up to her collarbone." After all, Asher had been subjected to, according to Nikas, the real reason she turned down the 1995 offer to co-own the business was that she couldn't be so closely tied to Guggenheim. Yet she stayed. A peculiar decision, one might think, given all the unpleasantness she claims she was experiencing. She's young, 9 years out of college, still early in her career, says Nikas, by way of explanation. Her concern was that Barbara would disparage her if she quit, if she took clients, if she went somewhere else. No evidence from that time suggests Guggenheim would be inclined to disparage her, but that was her perception, says Nikas. There was something else that would come to trap Asher. For all of her attention to detail and obsession with dotting every I and crossing every T, she did not insist on anything in writing when it came to her partnership with Guggenheim. Asher said about the newfound arrangement, keeping her nose to the grindstone and working as independently from Guggenheim as she could, says her lawyer. As a result of her work with dealers in New York and London, GAA's profits soared, says the complaint. As time went on and Guggenheim aged, Asher, it seems, began to perceive an imbalance, and it rankled her. She was doing the heavy lifting and bringing in the commissions, while Guggenheim was losing her mojo and constantly needed Asher to step in. As chronicled in the complaint, there was the time in 2005 when Guggenheim instructed Asher to come to L.A. to look at a Diego Rivera with a major Hollywood couple. I'm not going to be good at discussing the Rivera with these clients, and you sound so much more articulate. And I see how these clients respond listening to you, Guggenheim is quoted as saying. The time in Palm Desert, California, when she asked Asher to help sell a Rothko. She faked losing her voice because she was afraid to answer questions from the collector. The time when Guggenheim asked Asher to come to Los Angeles to see a certain Joan Mitchell painting on behalf of client Tom Cruise. Because, as she told Asher, I don't know what I am looking at. According to Asher's filing, while she was busy doing Guggenheim's job, Guggenheim was indulging in a lavish lifestyle, expensing non-business things like stays at luxury spas and Fields travel. She also complained that for Barbara Guggenheim, gossip, fame, and status are an obsession, an odd objection, given that Asher went head first into a niche marked by high-status objects, celebrities, and heat-seekers. She cites as an example of this obsession Guggenheim's book, Little Known Facts About Well-Known People. Guggenheim plucks a copy from the coffee table at her apartment and flips through to show you its content. Quaint illustrations and innocuous factoids about the likes of Gandhi, Winston Churchill, and Benjamin Franklin. Because I am so obsessed with fame, she says facetiously. Then came Guggenheim's alleged demeaning and bullying behavior. Like the time in Los Angeles with a potential celebrity client in 2019. Guggenheim, according to Asher's complaint, had made a comment about having Googled the person beforehand. When an embarrassed Asher tried to change the subject, Guggenheim allegedly lashed out at her, claiming that Asher's first job was sweeping her floors. If Asher was getting bullied, she didn't speak about it to her friends. According to London-based art lawyer Pierre Valentin, who counts Asher as a friend, I remember overhearing conversations between Abigail and Barbara. I could hear Barbara screaming down the phone. Now, is that bullying? I don't know. I've heard shouting matches between the two, but it seemed to me at the time that it was their way of communicating. On the occasions where Asher mustered the gumption to confront Guggenheim about her disapproval, Guggenheim would shut her down by making reference to her secret weapon, according to Asher. That would be her then-husband, the fearsome Fields, whom Asher claims loomed over their partnership as a threatening presence. Guggenheim, according to the complaint, let her know that Fields believed that Guggenheim had been too generous with her. But mainly, it was the use of the term secret weapon that Asher took as a threat. The claim is dubious to Pizer, who points out that Guggenheim referred to Fields as my secret weapon all the time as an affectionate joke. He was the man who'd always have her back. You would only interpret Barbara calling Bert her secret weapon as a threat if you didn't know Barb well, or you completely lack a sense of humor, she says. And then, from 2016 to 2022, Guggenheim's bizarre behavior reached new heights, reads the complaint, which illustrates the charge through a series of incomprehensible emails written by Guggenheim along the lines of this. Arrange, please. I was supposed to see a Moran at... And these are just horrible misspellings here. At Q-N-A-I-E-D-S, but... Didn't WW, I thought it A-S-S-E-Z for the sick house, and you would go see it first. There's one outside the men call bedroom, Q-N-D, because if sprints, and these are misspellings that I am trying to pronounce. The listener must understand. The part dues are staged. I thought some tragedia could be good. Also, he likes Star Wars stuff. Aha, about Gursky and Vihak Hellman's kin. So, Barbara's a terrible texter, admits Pizer. But what we don't understand about that, and I've known this because of 20 years of reading her miserable text, is that she's in constant motion. She's in the back seat of a taxi. She's running to catch a plane. She's prepping notes for her next lecture. She's having dinner with clients, flying to Chicago or something for some random dinner that she feels is going to be productive for her business. It's also possible that Guggenheim was just showing signs of age. Indeed, Asher's complaint sees fit to note her mental decline. In 2022, the issues that had been brewing came to a head. It was an emotionally turbulent time for Guggenheim. Fields, who'd been ill for several years, died that summer. She'd started seeing Petrikov, and the two were planning on getting married. Asher had had it with the imbalance of their work output. With the help of Robert Mandeltort, an outside accountant who'd worked at the company since the 90s, now acting as mediator, Asher proposed revising the old oral agreement. For 30 years, they had split the revenue equally. Now, she suggested, they would separate their commissions into Guggenheim's bucket and Asher's bucket, with each drawing individual revenue from their individual sales. Any commission that involved them both would go to the old combined pool. Here we get to the crux of the dispute. Asher contends Guggenheim verbally agreed to the proposal, and that they even hammered out details about pay structures. According to Nikas, once the agreement was made, Guggenheim was satisfied and invited Asher to her upcoming wedding. Sharon, Guggenheim's lawyer, disputes this account. VGA's position is that so-called mediation was a charade designed to extract lopsided terms in Ms. Asher's favor, which failed and never resulted in Ms. Asher's compensation terms changing. Ms. Asher can point to no writing between her and Ms. Guggenheim ever confirming any change in terms. Nikas counters that there had never been a written agreement regarding the business in the first place. In fact, Guggenheim's complaint is premised on an oral agreement between the parties, he says. Whatever the case, when Asher started her own Asher Art Group in March 2023, she claims she was following through exactly with what had been agreed upon, while Guggenheim experienced it as a betrayal, as Asher, in effect, stealing part of the company Guggenheim had built over 40 years. In April 2024, Guggenheim fired Asher and months later filed a complaint, alleging that Asher had secretly launched her own competitive art advisory business while she was a fiduciary of BGA, and that Asher had used company funds for personal expenses. The suit also names Mandeltort and Asher's assistant Jessica Lewis for being liable in aiding and abetting Asher. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for the blind and print impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available at our website as a podcast. That's www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.